This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me. I check my mailbox every day for any sugar you send my way.
So Cheryl, welcome back. I guess welcome back to both of us.
Welcome back to you, Steve.
It's the new year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. And to you also. But more intriguingly for me, like, what has your life been like? I myself have not had a huge movie debut that has happened in my life. I've had changed many diapers and so forth. But what has it been like, the deluge of having Wild come out and all that, the blizzard around it?
It's really, truly, I think, the most surreal experience of my life. It's one thing to have your book made into a movie, which I think is, you know, itself a pretty extraordinary experience, but that book is about a real experience, you know, that I lived through. It's about me. Reese Witherspoon is me on the screen. And I've had, you know, so many different emotions about the experience. It's delightful. It's glorious. It's exciting. It's also scary. When I wrote the book, as you know, you're a writer, you put yourself in a really vulnerable place when you write true stories about yourself. And in Wild, I went to all those places. I really tried very hard to be as candid and transparent as possible. But, you know, I was in control of every word. Every sentence in that book was a decision that I made.
Right.
And so the movie, it's in somebody else's hands.
Right.
And so to have it received in the world is a whole different experience, because now thousands of people have seen it and many of them have written to me. They talk to me about things that I've lived through. They mention my mother by name, but they also tell me their own stories. They say very commonly, "You don't know it, Cheryl, but we're
That's
best friends.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's my life. You've written my life." And when I first started getting those letters at the beginning when Wild came out, I thought, well, that's uncanny that, you know, we have so much in common. I have so much in common with this person or that person. Mm-hmm. And then what I learned is we actually all have more in common than we thought. We just conceal it.
Right.
You know, we don't bring it into the public space. And that's what writers and artists do.
That's right. Human beings are constantly telling two different stories. Every human being is telling two different stories at the same time. The story of who they want the world to think they are, the public self, and the story of who they know themselves inside truly to be.
That's right. Strangely, this experience where I have been in the public eye more than I ever expected, frankly, I've had to learn how to trust my private self. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but to honor the actual person I am.
It's so tough, though, because I think for a lot of people, we're constantly trying to modulate between those two stories. And frankly, what makes most of good literature is the collision of those two stories. The moment when Humbert realizes that he's not just some grand European romantic, but he's a molester who's, you know, exploited this girl and ruined her life in some way or contributed to that process. That's what makes great literature, is that collision of those two stories. But of course, That's in real life. We can't control it. We can't shape it. We can't turn it into a healing journey.
So that's what we're going to talk about in this episode of Dear Sugar Radio. The difference between the public self and the private self, or sometimes even if it's not necessarily a public self, we're not talking about that in terms of fame necessarily, but rather the projected self.
That's right. What the world expects you to be, what you expect yourself to be, because the world expects it, and who you really are inside.
You, when you were talking about literature and the collision we've seen in so many characters, oftentimes the main drama of the great literature is when that character decides that the center will no longer hold, that self that they've projected is no longer valid. You see this especially in narratives of women, women who have really, you know, throughout time in so many cultures have been, I guess, more strictly held under sort of cultural expectations of who they should be and how they should behave and
That's right.
They should love and all of those things. And when they step out of that, that's such a powerful and dramatic moment.
Right.
One of the things I really reminded, you know, when I was talking to Reese Witherspoon about the role and also to Nick Hornby about the screenplay, is I said, you know, obviously, I decided to hike the Pacific Crest Trail at the weakest moment of my life, at the bottom point of my life. But what I encourage both of them to remember is at the weakest moment of my life, I decided to go hike on a wilderness trail for 1,100 miles.
Right.
You know, so I reached into my strength in the midst of my deepest sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
There were good decisions made amidst some very terrible decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that that's a really important thing. I mean, it's certainly something I know we both talk about when we talk about giving advice, that hardly anything is all one thing.
Right.
You know, that every person who's ever made positive change in their lives did so probably from the position of being down on one's knees. And that's certainly where I was when I decided to do the thing that set me really on the path to where I am today, sitting here across from you.
Right.
And so I think in some of these letters we're going to talk about today, a lot of those people are in that place. Which brings us really to our next letter from a woman who has a self-identity as one thing and, you know, had an experience in a relationship in which she's forced to question that. It's been challenged. Let me read the letter. Dear Sugar, I'm experiencing the loss of a great love and a major crisis of trust in men. I fell in love with a man when we were both 26. We fell in love quickly, fully, foolishly. I had never been so sure of any feeling for another person in my life. We planned to get married. It was never a matter of if, but when. From arm's length, I can now see the red flags that were always there. My love would comment on another woman's clothing and ask me, "Why can't you wear a little dress like that?" He flirted openly with other women in front of me. He told me in graphic detail about former partners. He urged me to skip meals, get cosmetic surgeries, and all the while to be more confident. He was fixated on all of my physical flaws, a bump on my leg, a few, quote, extra pounds. I'm 5'5 and about 125 pounds. Once he referred to me as a fixer-upper and laughed. The message I got, either explicitly or implicitly, is that he was doing me a favor, not just by being with me, but by reminding me that as a woman, my value derives from my appearance. Towards the end, he slung more mud than ever before. The words repulsive, unfeminine, lame, and obese were used to describe me. I blocked off all connection. He remains convinced that he was in the right. He never said he was sorry. I, of course, am stunned, and I also still kind of love that deeply wounded fucker. Sugar, are these fucked up thoughts about my weight, my flaws, my sensitivities, my clothes, my makeup, are these in the heads of all the men I meet? Was my love just brash enough to articulate them? Is true respect for women even possible from a man? I thought this guy loved me for my ambition, my values, my humor, my kindness. But he just so clearly didn't. I'm hurt and angry. I look at my own face in the mirror and it's hard not to cry. I spent my young life carving out a sense of identity that didn't revolve around my appearance. For that, I was proud. I can sense it slipping away with this loss. What do you think? Your friend, a wounded feminist.
Wow. There's a part of me anyway, I'm sure you as well, Cheryl, that's just like, thank God. Thank God she is away from this toxic, misogynistic, you know, asshole. I mean, God, love warps the mind. What we consent to, what we put up with. he's making her feel like she's worthless. And it sounds like for a long while, she really consented to it. And the interesting question is, when you have a public sense of yourself and an internal sense of yourself, especially as a feminist, why is it that in the personal realm, we can for so long put up with absolutely cruel, abjectly cruel, denigrating, misogynistic behavior? Does this feel familiar to you at all, Cheryl?
Well, I've avoided men who have been mean to me about my body and my looks. And that's not because I'm, you know, some sort of advanced form of feminist. It's just for whatever reason, men who adore me are my fetish. You know, like I have been lucky enough to be attracted to men who have been really respectful to me, you know, about those things. But I want to say the piece that I do deeply relate to, and I want to just reassure wounded feminists about this, is she is so not alone. I mean, I am a feminist. Right. Most of my friends are feminists. And all of us struggle with, you know, the difference between our ideals and our values and the decisions we make in our personal relationships, the things we think about.
Yep.
You know, I think that the least important thing about a person is how they look. And I spend a lot of time and money and brain energy and spirit energy worrying about how I look.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a sorrow. It's a conundrum. It's really hard. It's a hard thing in my life.
I want to say that the one thing I've really noticed, and I want to ask you about it because it's really striking to me and I'm genuinely curious about it, is like you're in this weird world of Hollywood and dresses and having to have the dress for thus and such award show. And obviously, I'm super happy for all the success that the book and the movie have had and so forth. But when I see you anguishing over or thinking about what dress should I wear, I'm like, don't buy into that crap.
Well, what I'll say to that is it's a lot easier said than done.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that I have really struggled and had to really talk to myself. Right before Wild premiered, this letter writer, Wounded Feminist, she talks about looking herself in the mirror and seeing what she sees. And yeah. Right before Wild premiered, I went into the bathroom and I looked myself in the mirror and I said, you are not allowed to think anything negative about your body, your weight, or your looks anymore. If you think those things, push them out of your mind. And I have done that. I've done that since this was late August. This doesn't mean I feel great about myself. It means that I just decided I couldn't do it because I knew I was about to enter this season of this Hollywood red carpet deal, that if I allowed myself to sort of be self-loathing,
right, that
something in me would fall apart. Now, on the other hand, I've also decided to comply with the look. I do go and, you know, get the dress I need to get that's going to look right. I wear high heels for the first time in my life. I've talked about how I hate high heels and how I really, it often comes off as a joke when I say I think the final liberation of women is tied to the shoes we choose to wear.
I honestly think you should.
But I'm actually being very sincere when I say it.
Yeah.
You know, as somebody who's just written a book about how powerful it was for me to walk 1,100 miles on my own.
Yeah.
I think it's powerful to refuse to wear shoes that you can't walk a mile in, you know? But I've worn those shoes.
I know, but I was like waiting for the moment that you just rock the red carpet in like beat up hiking boots.
You do.
And like, I mean, the tough thing is it's easy for a dude, it's easy for a man to say like, hey, you know, quit worrying about it, man. You're sexy how you are, whatever. I mean, I was really indignant on your behalf when I saw like the photoshopped version of you in Vogue. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That's not what Cheryl Strayed looks like. That is like some kind of android.
Thank you.
I mean, for you to
have gone—
Well,
and the New Yorker, David Denby, in the review of Wild called me big bodied.
Right, don't get me started with that. But the reality of it is, I look at that and say, you have been in this experience where, and I know this is putting too much on you, but like, I want you to be the person who's like, you know what? No.
Well, I wasn't allowed to see that photograph. If I had seen it beforehand, I would have. Yeah. I would have fought that. You know, that photograph came out a month before Wild was published. And because of it, I have asserted myself in that regard and said that I don't want to be photoshopped. And, you know, I want to say, and this really connects with Wounded Feminist's question. You know, you want me, and I think other people, you know, want me to show up on the red carpet wearing
hiking boots
and, you know, and being, you know, very assertive in that regard. And I have twin desires. I want to be that person.
Right.
I also want to be pretty. I want to be seen as pretty. I want to be able to stand next to movie stars and not look terribly out of place. And one of the things that I will say is that my dress size is a 10 or a 12, which in real life is slightly smaller than actually the average American woman. Mm-hmm. In Hollywood, is obese. And, yeah. You know, a majority of women wouldn't actually say on the radio what their dress size is if it was a double-digit dress size, like mine is, okay? So the fact that I do go on the red carpet,
right,
and I do stand next to the size 0 and 2 beautiful actresses who do incredible work, and unfortunately who part of their work, a requirement of it is being conventionally beautiful and slender. That's right now, like the radical act I can do, that I can stand up and say, you know, on this podcast and into this microphone, what dress size I'm wearing, and wear it with a smile and not have that internal tape in my mind saying, you're fat, your belly is round, your butt's too big, you know, whatever it is, you have a double chin, like all of those things that women right. say to themselves. And so the other thing I just want to talk about really quick before we go, we're going to have a guest on the show today, the wonderful writer Roxane Gay,
yes.
who wrote Bad Feminist and is a great essayist. What I want to say to Wounded Feminist is I haven't ever met a woman who doesn't struggle with feeling okay about yeah. her body and her beauty and her size and all that stuff. So let's call Roxane Gay and see what she has to say in response to this letter.
Let's do it.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Roxane. It's so nice to talk to you.
Yes, it is.
Where are you?
I'm at my parents' house in Naples, Florida.
Do you sense a pattern? The really successful and smart women writers we know are all in Florida in the winter. That's where they go, while we're in Portland and Boston being miserable.
Yeah, well, I just got here yesterday. I'm doing a visiting writer thing for a semester, so.
Nice. Congratulations. That's awesome. Congratulations on all your amazing success over these last couple of years. I'm so happy for you. I know I've told you that before, but just wanted to say it live.
Yes. We're old school rumpus. I'm an old school rumpus fan of your work, Roxane, and it's such a delight to see you enjoy a larger readership. And we specifically want to know, because you've thought so much and written so much so eloquently about this issue of the intersection of your personal life and sort of sense of yourself in the world and the idea of having a public persona as a feminist. What did you think when you read Wounded Feminist's letter?
You know, I just wanted to give her a hug when I read her letter.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, I completely understand that you have these feminist ideals about how you know better, and then you still fall into these relationships where you forget everything you know as a human being, a woman, a feminist. And so, honestly, I just wanted to give her a big hug.
Yes, we felt her compassion for her, too, that, you know, we talked about it a bit before calling you, and I was saying that she's not alone, you know, as you've written about. I don't think there is such a thing as a feminist who, you don't always live every value out. You know, it can't come to bear in every relationship or every way that you present yourself to the world. It's just impossible.
I'm interested specifically to ask Roxane about the idea of feminism, which I think is just been so maligned and distorted. And I love the way in which you're trying to navigate in Bad Feminist between the difference between feminism as a dogma that's constricting and ultimately gets sort of flattened out into caricature and having it play a real and meaningful role in the lives of men or women who identify as feminists. So it doesn't feel like a cheap label either. I love the moment where you talk about, you know, and just give this beautiful little concrete example of, like, I identify as a feminist, but when there's some repairman who comes to my house and, you know, I will play a certain role because I know that it's just going to be more effective in that particular little social interaction. You know, do you say that sort of with pride or with shame or resignation?
It's a little bit of resignation because I think that as a woman, and especially as a Black woman, I can't use every moment when people are being ignorant as a teaching moment because
right.
then I would spend all my time teaching.
Right.
And the one thing that struck me was, like, her first question was, will he ever learn? I was just like, girl, who cares?
That's right.
Yeah.
Will he ever learn? That's not your problem.
That's right. That's his.
We do feel that way. I mean, you do have this desire when you feel this deeply betrayed. There's some part of me that's always like, but I want them to realize it. I want them to realize. And what we're really saying, I think, is I wish I had realized it. But it gets expressed as this like unrequited sense of like, but I want, he can't just move through the world being that big an asshole.
Well, and that's right. She's very angry and hurt that he hasn't said sorry. And
right.
He doesn't feel sorry.
He doesn't feel
which
sorry.
Which is, you know, and I think this is a pretty fresh heartbreak. And all three of us have had to move through that stage of grief before where you want the person to essentially take it all back. Like, please unsay that you said those cruel things to me. And the fact of the matter is people hardly ever do.
Right.
One of the things I was so struck by is the particular cruelties, the particular ways that this man diminished wounded feminist, they weren't actually particular to her. These are things that we've heard men say to women to keep them down time and time again in relationships, online. I mean, pretty much all of the hate mail I've received, and I'll be curious what you have to say about this, Roxanne, if this is true for you as well. Pretty much all of the hate mail I've received from men, it involves some sexual comment or some comment either on my body or what should have been done. I got a letter one time from a guy saying, you should have been tied to a tree and raped on your Pacific Crest Trail hike, which I thought was really interesting. I was like, well, oh, that's, you know, he's telling a story about himself.
That's right.
And about what he thinks about women who, you know, dare to walk alone in literal and metaphorical ways. And so I hope that wounded feminists can take some comfort in I guess, not taking this personally, even though it feels incredibly personal, and I know she's devastated by it, but that actually this man is talking to her in a way that is deeply connected to a system that through the ages has been meant to keep women from wanting respect and demanding respect from men.
It's so pro forma. Misogyny.
It
like
is.
Unfeminine, repulsive.
Absolutely.
Obese. It's like, oh, dude, get a new act, you know?
Yeah. And I hope she can also take comfort, a small amount of comfort, at least in knowing that even if she addressed every single one of his criticisms, there would be more.
That's
it's
right.
Not about who she is. It's about him.
Right.
And how he wants to just take a woman down. I mean, I think we've all had these kinds of relationships where you are with someone for whom you can never be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you try and you keep trying to become better and better and better for them. And it doesn't matter because they keep moving the goalposts. And that's what this guy was doing with her.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter, and one of the things that this letter writer is asking is, are these thoughts, these pejorative, undermining thoughts, bigoted thoughts in the minds of all men? And the truth is, they're in the minds of a lot of men. And a lot of it is put out into the culture because men, I think, deeply doubt their own masculinity, their own worth, their own bodies, and so forth, and they put that off on women. I just want to make clear, men struggle with the same thing. I've struggled with it all my life. Men don't talk about this stuff, but they struggle with it so much, and a lot of what's going on is that they put it on women.
Yeah.
They take that doubt and that uncertainty and they just make women feel small and diminished and in doubt. It's also a way of assuming power in the relationship, which is what this guy was doing.
Yeah.
You know, interestingly, when I wrote this book against football, and it was essentially saying, look, the values in football are really destructive. And the hate mail I got universally, the hate mail I got was so fascinating. Again and again, what people described me as was a big pussy. And it was so striking because I was sort of thinking, well, maybe one or two of those, but every single angry letter had something to do with calling me feminine or a woman. They mm-hmm. essentially revoked my genitals and therefore in their minds, yeah, my worth because I had betrayed the brotherhood. And, you know, and this I think has to do with the idea that men are also trying much more quietly and desperately to live up to a certain kind of masculine ideal that is being put out there and feel that they're failing. And I think what we do as a rule is find a woman to bully.
Yeah. I hope you're overstating it. But, you know, here's the thing, you know, at the heart of wounded feminist questions, you know, what's the way forward?
Right.
Leave this guy in the past. Roxanne, help me out here, sister. Are there men, are there men you have found and as friends and lovers and colleagues and so on and so forth, who you found to be respectful and loving and good? And I mean, I know Steve Almond to be one. I know my husband to be one. I know Stephen Elliott, the founder of The Rumpus, to be one, who we all know as well. I mean, I think that the wounded feminist is being overly despairing, and I think we all can be sometimes when we hear, you know,
well,
things like this
from
people.
Coming out of that kind of relationship, yeah.
Yeah, I think that kind of relationship absolutely shaped how you see men for a significant amount of time. But
yeah.
I must say that most of the men in my life, actually all of the men in my life presently, are wonderful and really embody for me what a man who's secure in himself and secure in treating women as humans looks like. And so I'm very lucky in that regard. I have tried in the past, I don't know, 10 years to just stop communicating with the bad men in my life. And sometimes I succeed, sometimes I don't.
Was that a struggle for you? I mean, earlier before you got on the phone, Steve was asking me, have I ever been treated this way by a man? And you know, I was saying kind of jokingly, but also serious, like, you know, really good men who love me and respect me are sort of my fetish. And I do know women who have been drawn to the opposite, you know, men who are abusive and disrespectful. Sometimes we just have one relationship like that. And I'm hoping that that's what's true for Wounded Feminist. But I'm wondering if we can give her some advice about how to, like, not make this a pattern. Do you have experience in this realm that you can give us some insight?
The realm of the douchebag?
The realm of the douchebag.
Absolutely. Until about 4 years ago, not even 4 years, 2 years ago, I was a professional douchebag dater.
Oh, my God. You had a douchebag fetish.
Kind of my specialty. I've had two relationships that are similar to what she's dealt with. One with a man and one with a woman. And in both cases, they were clearly projecting their own inadequacies. And I didn't know it at the time. I just thought, okay, I have to just fix myself because I'm the worst human being
right.
ever. The first thing you have to do is stop listening to that voice that they put in your head. And it does get in your head. But you have to stop listening to it. And that's the hardest part, is no longer hearing that. Like, every time you, like, move to, like, eat something other than a salad, you can hear them nagging at you.
Right.
You have to stop listening to them. And you have to start listening to yourself and trusting yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, before we had you on the line, I was talking about something I recently did with myself. I said, get your own voice out of your head that says those things.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that's really the challenge, you know, that we're up against, is that we internalize the opinions, not just of the people in our lives, but the messages we receive from the culture. And the message that so many, you know, that women from the beginning have received from the culture is that our power is in our physical attractiveness to men and our beauty and our looks and all of those things. And it really is a lifelong struggle. For me, part of being a feminist is not having gotten all the way there, you know, not to say, you know, I disregard all of those judgments and opinions, but to say, I'm going to do my best to be my authentic self in the face of so much pressure to be otherwise.
Absolutely. I'm still working on that.
We've all said, this is a life's work. Welcome to that muddled middle where we all live, where we're trying to hold those voices of self-loathing at bay. And yet there they are beside us, you know. And the fact that she's run into somebody who was really cruel to her doesn't dismantle all the work she's done.
That's right.
And it doesn't in any way lessen, I think, your ability to be a strong person, a strong feminist, and somebody who will find good love from somebody who will respect and honor you.
My soul is a weary and beaten down from all my misery.
Okay, let's go to the next question.
Let's do it.
Dear Sugar, I'm in my late 20s and a virgin. I know age shouldn't count when it comes down to it, but it's not just that. I've had no serious or casual romantic relationships to date. Whenever someone has shown the slightest romantic interest in me, and believe me, this tends to be few and far between, especially when he tries to get physical, I tend to withdraw from him. I've been thinking a lot about why this happens. I've had a very normal life. My parents are great, supportive, and understanding, but as I always say, as long as they approve of what you're doing. And that's been me my whole life. I'm a good girl. I'm the good girl. I could blame my lack of sexual relations on being a good Catholic girl, but I know that's not true. I'm not even a practicing Catholic, but my family is definitely religious. I don't want to disappoint my parents. I know this fear of disappointment goes back to seeing my father cut one of our cousins completely out of his life because she did the most abhorrent thing she could do for a Catholic. She got an abortion. Even as a 7-year-old, I knew his reaction was not right. But seeing the way he just stopped acknowledging her existence was a sign to me of things to come if I went against his approval. Not sure if it relates to all of this or none of this. Maybe it's just me and I'm really and truly asexual. Who knows? Signed, the good girl.
Here is my first question to you, the good girl. Do you have sexual desires? That is the central question around which you're dancing here. I can tell you, Cheryl, with great vividness, my first moment of realizing that I was a sexual being, I was 5 years old. I was living on a commune in Ukiah County called The Land, and I remember so vividly lying on a bed alone, away from everybody else, with a blue and white bedspread, lying on my back and having the most fantastic feeling I'd ever had. All I knew was that it felt incredibly good, and it also felt very worrying that somebody might catch me in this circumstance. I guess in a sense I'd caught myself. But I remember going like, holy crap, the body comes with this? And it was just an instinctual understanding that part of, not all of what bodies are for, but part of what bodies are for in a very primal way is they're portals of pleasure. And what makes me so sad for this letter writer is I'm heartbroken at the idea that she might never allow herself that, with or without a partner.
Yeah, to me, that's the first question I had, too. I think that experience you're describing...
Do you have one of those?
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I was about 5, and this is probably going to reveal, you know, more about my sexuality than I should say on the radio, but
good.
Here we go.
All right.
This is what we're in business for, Steve. You know, I was playing doctor with a neighbor boy mm-hmm. who was about my age. And
now, was he an MD?
And what's funny about it is there was nothing sexual about what we were doing, but there was just a dynamic and energy. Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, sensation.
Yes.
You know, I felt, you know, a sort of heat and tingling, you know, that I had never felt before. And that, and I just felt like I thought it was interesting. You said you knew that you didn't want anyone to sort of catch you in that moment.
Yeah.
I instinctively knew that this was something that I needed to keep private. And it was just a glimmer. It was an experience. And I had a few more of those throughout childhood. And then obviously when I was, you know, 13, 14, you know, reaching sexual maturity, that's when I discovered mm-hmm. the magic button that is the clitoris. Nobody told me about the clitoris.
I think it's like a horrible affliction. It's part of what I think of as embarrassing design, right? The idea that we come of age and start to become sexual in the world when we're 13, 14, mm-hmm. 15, we're so self-conscious. We're so down on ourselves. It's so easy for us to suddenly associate our sexual impulses, our impulse to receive and give pleasure is so caught up in this exaggerated sensitivity that we have about our shame and our bodies as a source of shame. And that to me is part of what I think has gotten mixed up here for the good girl. I thought of this passage describing this character in this novel, I Love Stoner. It's describing the wife. And here's how her upbringing is described. It's just, this was brought to mind by the letter. Her moral training, both at the school she attended and at home, was negative in nature, prohibitive in intent, and almost entirely sexual. And I think that's so true, especially for women, that the subtle and unsubtle messages that are sent by the world is that any pleasure that they receive through their bodies, especially sexual pleasure, is automatically tagged as illicit. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell whether she honestly does not have those impulses or whether they're just so suppressed. But I have a strong feeling that the reason she's asking this question is because there's some itch deep down within her that's saying, I think I might be missing out on something that's important. Otherwise, what is she doing asking us?
You know? Well, I think it's also really important that we pay attention to the language we use to describe ourselves and our lives and our situations. Mm-hmm. And to me, the phrase that sticks out is the good girl.
Right.
We know what that is. It's almost entirely tied to sexuality, female sexuality. I mean, to be a good girl is to follow a set of very you know, archaic and narrowly defined rules about sexual conduct. She also gives this interesting example of the cast out cousin, the cousin who did something that her father disapproved of and is therefore exiled. So I do think that what she's really asking here is probably bigger than sex, you know, right, forging her identity independent of her family. I think that the question she's going to have to ask herself, and sex is a big part of this, is, you know, is she content being the good girl? My gut sense is she's not. I think that people write to us for reasons, usually because they're not happy.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it can be so helpful when you have grown up in a household that had a very kind of restrictive way of thinking about, you know, something as big as sex, to really get an outside perspective. Like, I would really recommend that this young woman talk to somebody, maybe see a therapist who can help her make sense of who she is separate from her parents, her family, her religious tradition. This doesn't mean casting those things aside. God knows there are so many Catholics having great sex. God literally knows if you're Catholic.
You know? He keeps track.
He's keeping track.
The Jews he doesn't care about, interestingly. But the Catholics he's got, yeah.
You can be a good girl and have a really great sex life.
Yeah.
You can be somebody who honors her parents and their religious beliefs and is independent of them and makes choices.
Right.
All of these things are possible. And it sounds to me really what I think, and this is why I keep circling back to this good girl thing. You know, she has in some ways not just delayed her sex life, she's delayed her evolving beyond her family of origin.
Right. Because I think part of this requires really reflecting a little bit. And it does require a capacity to sort of say, what's been my relationship to my family? And why have I allowed that relationship to inhibit even the possibility of being involved with a man? And even before that, the possibility of just enjoying my own body. At a certain point, I don't want to set the prescription of, like, you know, when I'm 5 years old, lying on my back. But that was my body saying, even as a five-year-old, you have this remarkable capacity to have pleasure. And I knew there was shame attached to it, even before any baggage. I was on a commune. I wasn't raised in a good Catholic family. I was on a commune where people were dropping acid and hanging out in the sauna. But even still, I think part of the inborn human arrangement is that our pleasure comes with this dark twin that's shame, even if none of it's put on you by your family. But she's actually had a lot of stuff piled on, and she's got to start to unpile that and say, what's left is your body. And if your body desires to feel good and to have pleasure, that's got to be okay.
And since you've had such great reading recommendations so far, I would love to submit my own. A huge part of my sexual identity, or my developing sexuality when I was a teenager, was this book called The Pearl. Do you know The Pearl?
Yes.
Maybe I've told you about it before.
Is The Pearl, they dive?
No, they don't dive.
Tell me about The Pearl.
The Pearl. It's the collected editions of this magazine that was this underground illicit magazine that
fantastic.
Was put out in the 1800s in England. So this is a very, you know, it was absolutely illegal for this magazine to be published. It was called The Pearl. Mm-hmm. And it was these erotic stories told in serial form. And so, you know, you'd get, you know, the titles of them. I remember The Grandmother's Tale and Miss Coote's Confession and, you know, all of these stories that went chapter by chapter as each issue of this magazine was, you know, released. And they collected them and reprinted them in this book called The Pearl in the 1970s. And my mom, for some reason, had it on her shelf. Somebody probably had given it to her as a, you know, sort of joke birthday gift. And all through my childhood, it was there on the shelf. I never looked at it. And then suddenly when I was about 13 or 14, it was like this, suddenly I had this kind of like sonar where I could find the dirty things. And I found this book and I took it up to my bedroom, and it was never to return to my family's bookshelf. I don't think they noticed it. I read it so often that it honestly became a stack of pages in my drawer. I had this like secret part of my drawer, and I would just hold the pages and read it. And this is when I learned, throughout high school, I was actually sexually active. I lost my virginity when I was like 14 or 15, pretty young, too young, actually. I shouldn't have been having sex with this boy I was having sex with, but I was in love with him, and I felt like that was the way to keep him loving me.
He was certainly grateful.
But what was really interesting is, you know, I had a lot of sex in high school. And I never had an orgasm with my boyfriend. And it didn't even occur to me until really much later that I was even meant to have orgasms with him.
Wow.
But I had lots of orgasms in high school because I was with myself in the Pearl.
Yes.
So this is where I learned my body, my sexuality.
Right.
You know, I experimented. I would read the different stories in the book and see what, you know, repulsed me and what turned me on. And, you know, I really recommend, you know, go find erotic literature. I think especially for women, you know, narrative is such a powerful form, you know, and I think sometimes just allowing yourself to be open to those kinds of stories, it's like anything else, you know, what are the stories we tell about ourselves? What are the stories those closest to us have told us about us?
Yeah.
And I think this is a young woman who has allowed her parents to tell the story of herself.
Yes.
And it's time for her to write that story. Right. And maybe it starts with some really naughty reading.
Yeah.
So good luck to you, good girl. Please write us back. And we encourage you to sign your letter, the not so good girl, it turns out.
So, Cheryl, one aspect of this letter that we have kind of tread a little bit too lightly on, I think, is right at the end when the good girl says to us, maybe it's just me and I am really and truly asexual. Who knows? But maybe we need to get in touch with somebody who can discuss with us asexuality or in a broader context. And I thought, I had the feeling that we should call our dark arts correspondent, Stephen Elliott, not because he is asexual, but because he is sort of pansexual, which would include within it asexuality.
I think that would be perfect. Stephen Elliott, he's like pan-pan-sexual.
That's right.
Yeah, I think we tread lightly on asexuality because the letter writer, my gut sense was that we weren't talking about that, that she really isn't asexual. She's just maybe struggling with this identity as being the good girl and not being in opposition to a sex life.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like she's saying, well, maybe I'm asexual and that explains why I'm so inhibited or why I've steered clear of my body and its potential pleasures and right romantic involvement. But it's worth talking about asexuality because I think it is widely misunderstood, including by me, for instance. I have a hard time figuring out, well, what does that mean exactly?
Right. And I mean, I think sexual lust is really one of the most primal urges. I mean, we need to drink, we need to feed ourselves, and I don't know that I'd put sex in that same category in terms of survival, but it's certainly a primal urge, a primal need.
Well, our genes would put it right in that same category.
Would they? I mean,
yeah, of course.
What I mean to say is, like, you know, you won't die if you don't have sex. You will die if you don't eat and drink, but sex is right there.
That's right. But your genes don't know that, if you know what I mean. In other words, you know, genetically, and I don't mean to be reductionistic or, you know, but if you think of it in a bioevolutionary sense, that drive has to be strong enough to cause us to make all sorts of idiotic decisions.
Right.
Right. In the name of love. We could say in a certain way, well, maybe love is the delusion. Maybe love is the trick that our genes are playing on us.
As Pat Benatar said, love is a battlefield.
Well, that's right. She also said hell is for children, which I agree with.
You keep quoting these like sort of high art literary sources.
You just bring it right down
I'm
to
like,
the buck.
You know, Pat Benatar and the Pearl.
Yes. Let's go ahead and call Stephen Elliott, our beloved founder of the Rumpus, the person who birthed sugar in some larger spiritual sense, and our dark arts correspondent, who you might remember from episode one, our pilot episode.
Hi.
Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Stephen. So, Stephen, do you remember a few years ago, you sent me a documentary because you were so intrigued by it, and I seem to remember that you were, you know, you felt like an affinity for this documentary. It was about asexuality.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, what's the documentary called?
I think it's just called Asexual.
Asexual, yeah, I thought so too. Why were you so interested in it?
Oh, because I often think of myself, you know, as asexual, you know?
What does that mean?
That is not how I think of you.
It means different things to different people. Like, it can mean that you don't want to have what most people think of as sex. In other words, like, you don't want to penetrate anybody, even if you have desire. Like, if you have desire for, like, you want to be touched, you want to cuddle, maybe you want to do bondage, you want to give pain or accept pain, you can still be considered asexual if you don't like what we think of, what most people think of as sex. And I don't really enjoy what most people think of as sex. other people call themselves asexual because they don't want to be touched.
So they're celibate in a stricter sense of the word. They don't
exactly.
want to have physical intimacy.
Like, some people, you know, they're asexual because they lack desire. But I actually have a lot of desire. I'm never lacking for desire.
Do you know anyone, or have you ever encountered anyone who is truly asexual and that they lack sexual desire?
I don't think so. I don't know. I have to think on that one.
Yeah, I don't
certainly
know.
He doesn't remember.
Yeah, no.
You know, we probably have, and I probably have too, but we don't necessarily notice it.
Right.
Because we didn't sleep with them.
That's right. They did not to respond to our advances.
Exactly.
What do you think of the word, Stephen? I mean, you're somebody, right, who's obviously not into standard sex. Do you think asexual is a term that you, like, wear proudly, or is it something that's kind of a big catch-all label?
I think it's a little too broad, but when I was watching the documentary, I thought, oh my God, these are my people. There was, like, stuff in there that I related to so strongly.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's a huge problem, you know? Like, women are very forgiving. I've met many women, even if they're not into what I'm into, they're more than willing to put up with it. But what a woman will not put up with is not being desired.
Yes.
It's not the things I want to do that make it hard for me to have a relationship. It's actually the things that I don't want to do that make it hard for me to have a relationship.
Mm-hmm. So asexuality has, in some ways, made it hard for you to have the long-lasting intimacies. I mean, do you want that, or is part of it that you like having...
I want it. I definitely want long-lasting intimacy, and I want to, like, share my life with somebody. I want to share my bank account. You know what I mean? I want to just, like, integrate with somebody else. But it's very, very tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Your dating pool is incredibly small.
We're asking you about this because Steve Almond and I just had a letter from a woman she's in her late 20s and she's still a virgin. And, you know, she talks a lot about how she grew up Catholic with parents who have very kind of strict morals, and she feels that she's always been the good girl. And so she's wondering, you know, why is it that she always sort of recoils from physical intimacy? And she says, as an aside, that, you know, she wonders if she's asexual. And what we came to is, Steve and I sort of felt that it was more about her fears of, like, deviating from her parents' expectations than it was that she was actually asexual.
Well, you have to think about this, though, because you can't reprogram somebody. You know, when you're hypothesizing about why this person is asexual, it's like hypothesizing about why somebody is gay.
Well, we don't know that she's asexual. She didn't seem very strongly convinced she was herself.
Right.
If she fantasizes about it and she wants to do it, but there's something else holding her back, then it's quite possible that it's the result of her upbringing.
Right.
But if she doesn't fantasize about it and really doesn't want it, then it's more likely, I would imagine, that she's asexual, which also could be a result of her upbringing, but it's not something that's reversible.
Yeah.
Well, one of the other things, so the broader subject that we're wrestling with these letters, we also wanted to talk with you about, which is the idea of sort of your public face, the face you put out to the public, and your private self. You know, Cheryl and I were interested to talk with you about this because you're such an amazing example of somebody who has, at least in your writing, has done so much to sort of erase the normal barrier that we have between what somebody's public persona is and what somebody's private life is. And that book, My Girlfriend Comes to the City and Beats Me Up, is a great example because you say right at the beginning of the book, like, most of these things happened. 70% of these things happened. I'm choosing to call this fiction because I don't want to be, you know, quibbling over the details. But basically, dear reader, these things actually happened to me, Stephen Elliott.
Well, you know, I mean, when you're writing, every time you come out of a closet, there's always another closet. And a lot of times, you don't know what's in the next closet until you get out of the first closet, right? You don't know what you're holding back or what you're ashamed of until you get out of the thing that's occupying you right now. Like, if you're a transvestite, first you want to put on the clothes, you know, but then you want to go dancing. And then you want to, you know, soon you want to go dancing every night, and now you're ready to think about your relationship with your father. You know what I mean? Like, once you get this thing out of the way, all of a sudden, you realize this other thing that you have all this shame and drama around. So there's always something that you didn't know that you were dealing with, you know, and it's kind of definitely the benefit of coming out is that you get to find out what's next, what else is in your closet, you know, but it never ends. You're always holding something back.
Yeah.
And you've never found yourself alone, have you? Everything you've written, there have been people who've made contact with you to say, I relate, I identify, this is my story too.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Hey, Stephen, we have one quick question for you. What is the background noise that we're hearing?
Oh, I'm at this this reading of Freud, where a bunch of different people, poets mostly, are reading from Freud's work. I'm out in the hallway.
Of course. Of course you are.
It's perfect that that's what's happening in the background as we're talking about this primal sex stuff. It's Freud there in the background.
And he's sitting there going, no, I don't believe it. Everyone has a libido.
Freud is shaking his head. Thank you so much for articulating this to us. Because, you know, Steve Almond and I were talking before we called you, you know, just having not a very sophisticated idea of what asexuality is. And you really were very enlightening to us. So thank you. As always, you are.
You're the sweetest.
That they don't call me sugar for nothing, honey.
That's right. Thanks, Stephen.
Love you, sweetie.
Love you too. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Love Stephen Elliott.
So do I.
He's the person who's like, sometimes we're so deep in our own heteronormative, like married with kids anxiety. And he's just like, yeah, actually, it's a big, wide jungle out there. And you're in a very small little habitat. I love the way he thinks about it. You always have to move from one closet to the next closet. It's really a version of that idea of the unreliable narrator, that you're always telling the world one story. And it seems to me you never actually get to the point where you fully are aware of who you are to the world. Mm-hmm. You only realize that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line, you go, oh, that's who I was.
Yes, indeed.
We've come to the end of another Dear Sugar podcast. I have important things that I need to tell you. Dear Sugar is produced by WBUR in Boston.
Lisa Tobin is our producer and editor, and she rocks the shit out of the earth.
She rocks the shit out of the earth. The earth is now dangerously lacking in shit.
It is. She's brilliant and beautiful. Honestly, aren't we so grateful to Lisa for all of her great work? This week's show was recorded at the fabulous Mississippi Studios, which is in my beautiful hometown of Portland. Okay. You can also get a drink here and a mighty fine burger and a big old kale salad in grand Portland tradition.
Yes.
Thanks to Jim Brunberg, our engineer there.
New episodes of Dear Sugar are released bi-weekly, and we will begin airing weekly later this year.
If you all keep writing us questions.
Yes.
DearSugarRadio@gmail.com is the address. We would love to hear from you, sweet peas, honestly. DearSugarRadio@gmail.com. Thanks.